Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. I'm the second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where family B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Boaz Gilad. Boaz has spent decades operating in high-pressure environments where performance was not optional. After building and leading a successful real estate company, taking it public, and running it for years, he experienced the other side of entrepreneurship as well. Loss, bankruptcy, and rebuilding after a hostile takeover changed the trajectory of his career. What followed was not retreat, but reinvention. Today, Boaz works with founders, executives, leadership teams, and high performers around the world as a performance coach, speaker, and advisor focused on discipline, execution, and sustained growth under pressure. He is also deeply involved with the YPO organization and works closely with many family businesses navigating transition, stagnation, leadership evolution, and generational change. And in a business environment now being reshaped by AI, uncertainty, and accelerating disruption, his perspective on performance and adaptation feels especially relevant. Boaz, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Thank you, Ed. I'm so happy to be here.
Same. So let's start at the beginning. You built a successful real estate company, took it public, and then lost it through a hostile takeover and bankruptcy. Looking back now, what was the hardest part of that whole experience psychologically?
Wow. So you said in one line my entire 20 years of career. So I'm assuming you're asking about the crisis, like the end when
yeah,
things, you know, when things not go well. I would say that the most difficult thing for me actually was losing money for others. Because, you know, as an entrepreneur, you take risks all the time. And, you know, I know you deal mainly with family businesses, which is a little different dynamic, depending on the generation. We could talk about it later. But as someone who, you know, I came to the U.S. 33 years ago, I'm like, you know, I came from nothing. So therefore, that this kind of like this drive that I can take risks, that I have a high tolerance to risk, was not my concern. I think the fact that you know you're going to lose so much money for so many people, and mean the investors, the people who work for you, and employees, and contract and subcontract people you know for many years, I think that was the most stressful thing about it. Like, how do I communicate with them? How do I take care of them? How do I make sure they don't get as hurt as? And I think that was the thing that kept me awake for pretty much 6 months, I would say.
Yeah, I can imagine. So when someone builds a business and then loses the business they built, what breaks first? Is it confidence? Is it identity, trust, or is it something else? When you look back on your journey, what was it that kind of broke for you first?
Well, I think the question you're asking is it's a little bit more complex. Maybe you didn't mean that to be complex, Ed, but I think I hear it in a more complex way, because there's external breakdowns and the internal breakdowns. So let's separate them. And again, we can go as deep as you want on those. So let's talk about external. It's very simple, right? What breaks down is trust. Okay. That's the first thing that breaks. And what do I mean by that? You're an electrician. You come to my real estate development company, and you know that Friday come in, you sign, if you know construction, you sign the waiver forms, and you get a check. That's the relationship. You give me work, you finish the work on time, I give you a check, you can pay your employees, right? If you come to my office and my CFO or my controller or the secretary in the end just go like, oh, well, look, there's no check this week, come back Monday, and you're looking for me and you're sitting in the entrance in the lobby of my office and waiting for a check, there's a beginning of a crack of trust, and one feeds the other. So you're not going to work as hard on Monday morning with a crew because you're like, oh, maybe boss is going out of business, right? So one thing led to the other. So it's not externally, I think it's the trust. The trust between you and the bank that gives you the money. It's trust between you and your customers. So somebody, again, my case, real estate development, someone calls, say, I have a leak. Instead of showing up within an hour to fix the leak, you show up a few hours later because you were dealing with so many headaches and problems with employees, et cetera. And of course, subcontractors, contracts, et cetera. So I think that's trust is the fundamental thing, okay? I think internally, what breaks is, well, maybe it's also trust because it's trust in yourself.
You see.
Because you look as a CEO or a person who, whether you run a small bodega or you run a huge company, it's still CEO, right? You do 80% of the time you do sales. And when I say sales, I'm not saying you're selling to customers. You're selling to your employees, the vision. You're selling to investors. You're selling to yourself. Look, I can do it. And when things don't go the way you want, fine. But when they constantly not going the way you want, suddenly you're like, oh, maybe I don't have what it takes. Maybe that, and you start to look, you point the finger. I love that. You know, when I work with clients, like, pick, you, the point of finger, they said, as we work together, the finger turns. I don't know if you can see on the camera, like, point to yourself, but because you sound like, oh, it's the economy, it's the politician, it's the cost of, it's tariff, it's the, whatever the reason. Again, I'm not saying that there are not external impacts, but you start trusting yourself, your ability to manage, your ability to deal with the crisis. And I think that's where things start to collapse slowly. And then there's a moment, there's like a tipping point when just one more gram and then boom, the whole thing collapses.
But that's a great I love your framing because it's absolutely true. And I think before we even got on, I was commenting, hey, I was starting, in my own journey to question trust in myself, I'm wondering, does that do you ever get over that? Even after 30 years in business, the CEOs always sometimes question themselves, question their abilities, question their vision, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't. I'll tell you actually, I want to contradict what we just said in a way that I don't care if you trust yourself or not. And I'm saying it now as a coach, okay? Like someone who has been advisory board and coach. Trusting your trust is a very weak test, okay? Because it's built on history, it's built on like some knowledge and wisdom you collected. Either you collected because your dad was in the business, or your grandfather was in the business, or your mom was in the business, and things you've done. I give respect to it. But by the way, one of the best things about technology, and we have challenges with technology, is that you collect data. You and I spoke earlier about collecting data, right? So yes, trust has its space and we have to respect it, but I can't trust trust. I gotta have that kind of dance between trust and data. Because if you're trusting trust, consider that you're trusting it from a framework that might not be relevant anymore. You know, you might be building carriages, and you built your huge manufacturer in New Jersey, and you built carriages, and it's 1910, and you did very well this year. And your father was in the business, and your grandfather was in the business, and you're like, I'm, and now this guy, this Henry Ford guy, you know, I don't know if you heard about him, he didn't hear about himself. And he goes, like, no, I'm going to create an assembly line that gives that luxury thing called car to any person in lower middle class and middle class America, right? And you look at your trust, you're like, I trust, look, last year we did 300 carriages and this, I'm hiring other people, I'm buying material. Another thing, you are not looking at data, at trends of market. So I say, yes, I don't want to disrespect knowledge and kind of DNA of businesses, which by the way, we see a lot in family businesses, no? But it has to be data-based.
Wow, that's a great point. You've said something that I really wanted you to expound on. You said success is simple, but not easy. What do high performers consistently misunderstand about what sustained success actually requires?
Yeah, so I, first of all, again, I'm going to break it down, right? So because that's, I'm sorry, but like that's what I do for a living there, okay?
It's
So one is, why do I say simple and not easy? Because to make it really simpler for your listeners, as an example, climbing Everest is simple. You want to step, and then another step and another step, and 100,000 steps later, you're at the top of Everest, right? But it's not easy. No one can tell. You need special creator. So one of the things you have to distinguish the two, right? You have simple means like, can I look at the next thing I have to take? Or like instead of like take, but it has to be inside of a big picture. So it's, you know, so simple means like we have a line of actions I need to take, whether it's three actions or 3,000 actions. Depends on the complexity of if climbing Everest versus climbing the stair in your house, they're both climbing, right? Completely different, you know, list of things to do on the way. So sustaining is the key. You ask about sustaining, and sustaining is understanding that the key to sustaining a success is having the ability to break it down to simple steps. Because what happens is that we don't like to simplify things. Sometimes we like to, I know it sounds a little weird, and I'll tell, and we can talk about why I think this case, but because simple requires procedures and responsibility. All I'm asking you, Ed, is to take the next step. Don't look at the top of the mountain. Don't look, because well, here's what happens. You get, or you're like, you're going through your midlife crisis, and you said to your wife or significant other, I'm going to climb to base, to the, what it's called, first base, whatever it's called, like base A, whatever, like of the Everest, right? And then you get there and you prepare with your team and whole, and you look up at the mountain, you see those clouds, and you're like, holy smokes, I'm overweight. I did not train enough. My equipment, I didn't buy the top equipment. I'm not one of those rich guys who fly with a helicopter right to the base, blah, 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 blah. Instead of looking right in front of you on the floor and say, can I take this next step? Can I take the next step? Can you take the next step? Can I take the next? And then you can pick up on saying it. And again, having the infrastructure to support that, you will get to the top of the mountain. We are getting too cut off by that fear, by the big picture fear that makes it unsustainable to be successful.
Wow, that was pretty heavy.
Yeah, sorry. I'm like, you asked me a simple question. Here I am going off. So
I appreciate that. That's great.
forgive me. Yeah.
So, a lot of executives, rely heavily on motivation or inertia when things are going well. Maybe they're taking those first steps and those first steps are going really well. And they're like, okay, that's just going to carry me through. But what happens when outside forces or other things start to erode that drive and motivation starts to disappear? What can be done to kind of re-energize or re-engage in your work?
Yeah, so look, I want to debunk the motivation element first to start
Okay.
with, okay? Motivation is important, but motivation is like sugar. It's great, isn't it? It's 3 p.m. and you're like, I'm getting tired from work. I'm just going to grab that, you know, bar of chocolate or whatever it is, or one of those gels that, you know, the runners take in the middle of a marathon. It is great. It's an injection of sugar to your blood, it give you that boost. It's not sustainable. So the first thing one needs to understand is that motivation is very limited by design. Okay. And by the way, I know I lead, we spoke about it, I lead workshop to like thousands of people. You know, I see what are called motivation junkies. They spend tens of thousands of dollars on different courses, going from one course to the other course. And when I talk to them, and again, I don't want to judge, like, you know, but I like to give people a hard time because I want you to do the thinking, and we don't have to agree, right? But I want you to do the thinking, and then we can argue or, like, you know, go back and forth and say, look, I don't agree with you, that's fine, right? But a lot of people don't use they don't do the thinking, you know, their muscle. So he said, I said, okay, when are you going to start your business? He's like, no, one more course. I just registered, and then we're gonna sell my business. I was like, dude, like enough with that one more course, because what they're so scared, and I have a lot of compassion to those people, right? But they're so full of fear about failing that they go from one motivation to the other, and motivation is like sugar. We just said it. So therefore, if you are counting on motivation, you're never gonna make it. You're gonna have those like bursts. You're gonna have a New Year resolution. You're gonna have that January 2nd, I'm walking into the gym and I'm registering for the year. because that's a motivated moment. Like, I'm going to lose that 20 pounds this year. I'm telling you, by March, I'm not seeing you at the gym. Because if you're in the gym in March, that's not because of motivation. That's because of your commitment to your success, right? So the first thing is that CEO have to deal with is motivation is short-lived with you, short-lived with your employees, short-lived with everything. Okay? Now, to make it worse, how can you be motivated when the shit hit the fan? Sorry, Ed, I'm like, we're using words, but it's
That's
fine.
okay.
Yeah. Like it's all great to be motivated when you just did a $1 million sale this month and your predicted sale was like $600,000. But I want to see motivated when you have like, $1 million sales and you predicted it was supposed to be $3 million. You're not going to be motivated. So get curious, get interested in the question is, what is missing? What is lacking in my system, in my operation, in my team, that if I put it in, we can go back to the result we're committed to versus am I motivated or not? Because I tell you, I mean, I use it a few times. I always think about athletes, like top athletes, right? Do you want to tell me that Michael Phelps, when he was still swimming, was motivated every day to get into the water when it was like 5 a.m. and it's cold in the winter? There's no way he was. But and can you imagine he was like, no, I'm not motivated today. I'm not training. No, the guy won like what, 7, 8 gold medals, whatever it was when he was. All those guys, they yes, motivation is great, but it's kind of like the cherry on top. It's not the reason you're gonna use it. So forget about motivation. Get curious about success. About performance, not about motivation.
So going off of that a little bit, and I'll go back to the Mount Everest climb. So by any standards, a lofty goal. What is your position on goal setting when it comes to the people you work with? Is I know I've heard different accounts. So some people find goal setting is a very healthy activity, some find it to be an unhealthy activity if done the wrong way. What's your position, Roz, on goal setting? Is it a healthy pursuit? Is it necessary, or where do you see it?
Yeah, so first of all, I think goal setting is a critical thing. It's a critical thing. Why? Because look, life is a game. What do I mean by that? I want to explain my kind of theory around it, and my book is about that, right? So what is a game? A game is a set of time with a scoreboard, okay, and rules. So if you and I go outside and we have a ball and we have a basket and there's no scores, after a while, we're gonna get bored. It's nice to shoot it, and but when you're like, wait, whomever has the higher score on the board, higher score on the board, then like I'm gonna push you, you're gonna push me, you're gonna push yourself, and all that stuff, right? It makes it more exciting, right? So not setting a goal is like removing the scoreboard off the field. And can you imagine are we gonna spend our Sunday watching sports if there was no scoreboard? Just like, oh, look at all those great guys in tights running after a ball. No, it's like, come on, like 7 points. Like, no, that. So goal is critical, but the pitfall is that people stop after goals. So they live in La La Land. They say, I want to look at the scoreboard, or I like to look at the goals. That's the same thing for me. And I want to have more. So Ed and I play against each other. We can be in business. I want to have 40 points on the score on the board, and you should have 30 because I want to win. But if I sitting on the couch drinking beer, there's no way I'm going to win, right? So yes, goal is a very critical thing. And where the pitfall is not in the goal, not goal, is like, what are the actions you're willing to take? Not what needs to be taken. What are you willing to take to win? I have no problem with you saying, you know what, I'm not willing to do the work. I want you to be happy. Who am I to tell you as a coach or like, if you don't want to do the work, don't do the work. Seriously, but I get I don't think the right word is triggered, but like I get fascinated by people come to me, they hire me, and after like a week, I'm like, take your money back. You're not committed. Let's have a conversation to what you're actually committed to. I want you to be happy. But don't tell me you committed to this goal when you're willing to do the work.
Do you sometimes see it as and I've seen this show up, and I've seen it show up in family governed businesses and others, founder led as well. And I often think of it as two islands. One island is called the lifestyle business island, and the other island is called the enterprise business island. And a lot of times, it would seem that whomever the leader of the company is, whether it be first, second, third, whoever generation, wants to depart lifestyle island for enterprise island. And they set out on the journey, and then something spooks them, scares them, they don't like something, and they retreat back to lifestyle island. And you see this series of, planes leaving the island, not quite getting to the point of no return and circling back to their from their point of origin. What's your take on that? Do you see that showing up? And if so, how do you frame it?
I just wrote a piece for Substack, and I always look for like a cool a quote to start with. And this week I put Mr. Miyagi. I was like, do you remember karate? Yes, good. Karate, no, good. Karate middle, squash. Like it's the same thing,
Agreed.
right? So it's you stay on one island, right? Like you want to stay lifestyle business, fine, stay. You want to go to corporate, or enterprise, go. The problem is when people go and they don't have, and it's okay, by the way, it's okay to take risks and turn around. That's not a problem.
Okay.
But one is, first of all, I always question. I work, I belong to YPO. YPO, there's a lot of family businesses. And, a lot of times the decision to move from one island, as you call it, to the other is based on things that should not be a decision maker. Can be ego. For example, oh, my dad brought it to this level. I want to take it to the next level. They don't do the thinking. Like, you have to spend the time doing the thinking. And if that's the right decision for you, go for it. And by the way, it's okay to go for it and then decide it's the wrong turnaround. But when you go for something, go for something, right? But sometimes I'll be like, well, my dad this, I want to do double. But you're not willing to give up freedom of a lifestyle business. So you bring private equity to the business. And they're like, dude, we want out in 7 years because that's a model. We're going to bring professional management. We're going to push, 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 push. We bought 49% of your business or whatever it is. And then we're going to exit all. And you're like, but I like fishing. I like 2 months. Again, no, there's zero judges for me. And he's like, okay, so choose which, back to what we said, choose what game you want to play. There's no right or wrong game. I'll give you a really simple example. I'm going to go back to what you asked. Being married or being single, it's two different games. I'm not saying one is better than the other. Being married has one rules, and gives you also benefits. And being single has different rules and also gives you some benefits, a lot of benefits. I'm not telling you if you do married or single. All I'm saying, if you chose a game, stick with it, okay? So if you, and by the way, people forget, they get married and they want to play the other game, or they want to, they're single and they want to play the, So the same with the businesses, family businesses versus enterprises, right? So choose the game you want to play. Look, I took my company public, very different game. I was blown away by how little I knew about running a public company. Because before that was I was running and managing a balance sheet, profit and losses, balance sheet. Income, expenses, managing, buy cheap, sell expensive. That's it. Then you go public, and there's a crisis in natural gas in Europe, and suddenly your bond drops like nothing. You're like, how is that related to real estate construction I do in Brooklyn, right? Because it's such more complex. You have to learn to play that thing, right? So, going back to what you said about it. First of all, sit down. When I mean sit down, it's you, the founders, the family, whatever it is, and get really clear. Like, take a piece of paper, split in the middle, and write all the benefits and then all the challenges. Go interview people. Go talk to people who've done very well moving from family to enterprise. Go people to went to never went and stay like, I want to stay private or I want to stay family style, right? And have a discussion. Spend as much time on the decision than you're going to spend actually on the execution of it. So when you're fully committed, you're ready to be married to this idea. And that's good because the cost is not taking off from one island to the other. The cost is when you said, like, turn around in the air, like, oh, where do I go back? Do I go back? And then your dad pulls this one, your sister pulls the other way because she is not as involved in the business. And all those things people deal with. Well, we want to take the next level. And I think that's the key. So I don't think there's the right answer. I just think it's what's the right fit for you.
That's a great framing. And to your point, yeah, you can change your mind, but I think in fairness, and this coming back to, trusting yourself, being true to yourself, being true to the people around you. I think a lot of times senior leaders project that they want growth and they want to go become that enterprise business because that's what people want to hear, or that's what people around them need to hear, or they think that's what they're supposed to say. And if that's not true to what their belief system is and what their true desires are, that's not going to end well,
Exactly. That's
because you're.
exactly it. It's not going to end well. If you don't have the hunger, the capacity, the flexibility of doing it, it's not going to end well. You have to really understand what you're willing to sacrifice for the exchange of, and again, I'm all for family business staying family businesses if it's for you. There's so many benefits in family businesses. Also family, the challenges of if you want to exit enterprise is a better way because you go big or you go home.
So speaking of, you've worked with many family governed businesses across your career and coaching and in workshops. Where do you see stagnation or challenges show up? Some people say, I've heard many iterations of this on this show. Sometimes it's the second generation that builds it, but the third breaks it, and then the fourth fixes it. But I don't know that there's any hard and fast rules. But when you're working with a family governed business, where do you see some of the breaks in the chain? Is it sometimes on the generational transition, or what factors are starting to negatively impact that organization?
The answer is yes. Like every point we will choose in a family style generational business, we can find a moment of breakdown, but also a moment of opportunity. So I'm not trashing family businesses, but and I'm going to really generalize the conversation for a second, right? Generally, the first generation builds it has the biggest drive. They come from nothing, so they have nothing to lose. And the only reason they became as successful as they are is because they took huge risks. So they are in the risk management business. Okay. Second and third generation, and if it's big companies, even fourth generation, are in a different business. They're in the risk management business, not opportunity management business. Different things. First generation about opportunity management business. Second and third generation about risk management because my dad or my mom or my family have established something I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose because I grew up comfortably. I don't want to lose because there's a legacy to the family. I don't want to lose because I don't want to bring shame to my family, right? And one of the challenges is that many generations, I think most of the work I would say most of the most challenging work I do is convincing and working with the first generation to get off the road, the train. Because by the way, they did it by themselves and they don't know what to do anything else. They know to be in the store 7 days a week. So it's not like they don't. And the son will come to me, he's like, oh, my dad doesn't try. I just work with this woman. She's like, my dad doesn't trust me. I'm like, what do you want from him? He doesn't know what to do. He hasn't seen his wife for the last 60 years. Why you want to punish him? Not only that you want him to step down from the business, you also want him to go hang out with his wife, your mom, which he doesn't know. So you got to have compassion to every generation. So one of the most fragile moments in when there's a transition between generations, not just because of the risk versus opportunity management, but also because of the character of those people. You can't ask someone who's 80, legit, I'm going to take it back. You can ask someone, but you have to have all this compassion and tools and procedures and process to ask someone who is in 75 years old and only been in the business for 50 years to step away. There has to be a really true willingness on the old generation to play golf. By the way, most first generation don't play golf because that's what they know to do. So that, and then It's all about playing that dance, one step forward, half a step back, you know, and learning how to move into the next thing. Because if you don't do that, it's going to collapse. Because also, it's going to collapse if that founder, it can be founder, second generation or fifth generation, but like a mentality of a founder, holds on to the way she or he did it during their times. And life changes all the time. Look, well, I mean, I'm sure we'll touch on AI and all technology and everything. I mean, like, you hold into something, it's not going to be relevant. We spoke about earlier on the concept, but you know, Henry Ford coming around. You know, every generation has a Henry Ford, whether it's Amazon or Henry Ford or OpenAI. So I think it's about communication. It's about egoless activity. And proper governance. What do I mean by that? When there's a true communication inside the board, you can be you and your dad getting for dinner once a week. I'm not saying board, like, you know, even though I'm a big advice, I'm big component supporter of outside advisors, you know, proper board, advisory board, etc. And it doesn't have to be even paid one if you don't have a big company. But if you don't have proper governance, you don't have that ongoing communication and discussion about what's coming our way. And the most successful companies I've seen that do the proper generation transition is the one that prepared in advance. And that's very challenging.
It is. It is. And I like the way you frame that, because it is hard, I think, for a lot of those first gens to step away, and that's what they know, and that's what all they've known, and then to say, all right, well, you got to go do something else now. Well, what is
No.
that?
And by the way, I have all the compassion to the second generation because you grow up in the shadow of giants. And there's part of you who wants to prove that you're better than your dad. Or there's part of you who prove like, oh, my dad doesn't know how to do it. He's like, he's an old timer, you know, like, you know, a guy who ran a store, a clothing store, and I want to take it to like, you know, five location, all this. This is a very, very challenging thing to do. One other thing I ask people is say, if it was up to you, would you hire your sister as the CFO? And generally the answer is like, and then that gives you the answer. So I'm not saying therefore your sister should not be in the business, but understand the complexity. I'm saying you have a lot of compassion because your sister is someone you trust. She's not going to steal money. Hopefully she's not going to steal money from the business, right? And sometimes there's a problem because you trust too much your family and your cousin does steal money. But if it was a regular employee, you would have someone checking on them all the time. But because of your cousin, and your father and his brother started the business, you don't check on your cousin, and suddenly he stole $1 million from you. It happens all the time in businesses, right? But I'm asking you, did you choose that sister or that cousin or yourself as a CEO because you're so talented as a manager or because your dad gave it to you? And if you realize that's not the case, I'm not saying therefore quit. Let's get to work on the tools and the abilities that did not exist before you took on the role.
So you're talking to somebody whose sister was the controller here for about 15 years.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to do that. I hope it works well. Yeah. Yeah.
She did move on, and we did have a heart to heart, and she said, this isn't really my passion. I said, I know. And then she went on to what was her passion and had a great career, second
That's great.
career, really.
Yeah.
But somebody once asked me, because she's also 15 years my senior. So growing up, that was like a junior mom, if you will. So they said, well, how do you handle disagreements with your sister? I said, very delicately, because
It is so complex. You know, I was my mom's dad and my mom. I was my mom's boss for 5 years. She was in transition career and she came in and said, look, come work for us. It was very challenging because, you know, you go on the weekend, you want to hang out with your mom, you want to come go over to dinner, like she invites for dinner, and you don't want to talk about business. And you're a boss, and like this thing should any there's no perfect employee. I mean, I never had one. I had very, very good employees, but not perfect because I'm not perfect either. And it's very challenging. It's very challenging. And you can't compartmentalize. You can't be like, okay, 6 p.m. I'm going home. You're going home. I'm not going to see you till 9 a.m. this morning. It's all families and friends and, you know, issues and dramas and all. It's challenging.
100%. So across your career, Boaz, you've worked with obviously CEOs, founders, multi-gens, as well as some athletes and teams. Let's talk about discipline for a minute, because I think a lot of times when I look at the businesses we service, sometimes There's great discipline and sometimes not so great discipline. Is that something that people are just inherently born with or predisposed to have? Or is discipline something that you believe can be built systemically? Like you can forge discipline, you can create discipline. What's your position on that?
Look, it's can be built.
Okay.
But saying that, I think most of the disciplined people that I dealt with, they came into the system with that. So I think you were born with it, but therefore it's not like, okay, you're born with discipline, therefore I'm not gonna like deal with it. So your job as the manager is to put systems in place to create discipline. And we use a sport analysis before that. It's like, look, I'm asking you a very, and when I say Ed, you, I'm talking about the client, I'm talking about the person I'm working with, right? I'm asking you a simple question. What is the game you want to play? Let's go back to the basketball example, okay? If you and I play basketball on the weekend or like downstairs in the end of the day, we don't need anything. We need a ball. We can buy it like, Dick's Sports Good and that's it, right? Like, no, we don't need anything else, right? If you're LeBron James, you spend $1 million a year on your body alone. Trainers, coaches, massage therapists, nutritionists, all that stuff, because he's what, 40 something years old now? Over $1 million a year. Now, is his team more disciplined? I don't know. But if he operated the way you and I operate when we play basketball in the afternoon, it's not sustainable. So my question to this one, to you, is this. One is, what is the game you want to play? What's the level you want to play? You want to play NBA level? Or you want to play basketball in the hood, once a week? Then, here's a question about what you just said. Is your team around you sufficient to support the game you want to play? See, when I went public, I had to replace my entire accounting department, and they're wonderful. I had this amazing controller. She was incredible. She didn't have the knowledge, the ability, the manager ability, etc., to stay. And I tried for a few weeks, and just like I had to let it go. And I brought a CFO, which cost three, five times or more, right? Not because she wasn't amazing. She was amazing. Because she wasn't sufficient to the game I wanted to play. So can you create discipline? Of course you can discipline. But sometimes you drag people from your neighborhood to the NBA. And you think they're going to be there to support the next level. And how often does it happen? Come on. Like people like bring their, like the posses they walk around with. You see all those rappers, all those like sports people grew up in, in the neighborhood, and they're like, oh, who's this guy's the my money manager. And you go, okay, what are you, what are you at Goldman Sachs? Well, like JP Morgan, where you come? No, I grew up with Johnny, and like, I managed his money when he was like in college. I was like, you don't have the ability. And those are the cases when you hear the guy stole money, mismanaged it, and then the guy has, broken knees as a sports person in 30, and he's declared bankruptcy because the team he brought to the next level of game were not good enough. It wasn't bad about them personally. They were not good enough, the next level of management. They didn't know how to manage $50 million, $100 million revenues. So ask yourself, not do I have discipline or not? Say, yes, I can put discipline in. But is the team the right team to live in that level of disciplines?
That's a great point. I was also thinking of something else, as you were speaking. So early in my career, I was, in fact, I think it was my dad that turned me on to Tony Robbins. So I was very big on this whole, if you can dream it, you can achieve it, right? No matter what you want to do, you can be that, you can create it. Very, positive, opportunistic. And I was speaking to an old former mentor, and he's kind of like, well, really? I'm like, yeah, you can, if you can dream it, you can do it. He's like, well, what if you want a best, going with the basketball analogy, what if you want a best Michael Jordan? Can you do that? And he kind of gave me a moment of pause. And I guess I was wondering what your position is on that. Like, do you ever run into that where the leader or the leadership team has big aspirations, but they're just, from a casual outsider, grossly overly stated or overly optimistic based on maybe the team that they have or where they are and where they wish to be? That just where you have to kind of bring some voice of reason and say, okay, but here's the implications of that. And do you really want that? You know what I'm saying?
Yes. So first of all, I love Tony Robbins, right? So I have nothing. I think actually people misunderstand because the difference between him and other things that he did the work also that came after the kind of like I dream it, therefore I'm gonna go for it. But then he went for it versus just dreaming and sitting at home like I'm gonna manifest it, right? So just about him. But look, it's a very confronting conversation because you're saying you should dream. If you're a leader of a company, your job is to dream. If you're a CEO without dreaming, you're not CEO, you're COO. COO job is not to dream, it's to implement my dream as the CEO, right?
Yeah.
And the CFO, his job is to say, we can't afford it and it's not going to happen. But you rarely see a case when a CFO is someone's like, yes, let's go for it and let's take the risk because that's not the nature of a CFO. Because they wear different hats, right? So CEO, founder, must dream. I'm all about that. Dream it and she'll go it. But again, get fascinated, get obsessed by the infrastructure that will get you that level. So the confronting conversation is not about, oh, well, you want to be Michael Jordan. Because look, I think a lot of life is luck. Look at LeBron James, right? His body's just like he was lucky enough to born. Like he's the ultimate basketball machine. I'm more curious about Curry because this guy's short. If you watch the documentary about him, he was short. He was scrawny. But he's like, I'm going to break that one. And he developed an ability to throw 3 points and completely transform the league. Like every kid now plays basketball, shoots 3 points all the time. I mean, I think I'm a little older than you, but do you remember like in the 80s and 90s? There was never 3 points. Now every game is like 3 points, 3 points. Why? Because Curry came in and goes like, I'm short. So what? I'm going to be like a magician when it comes to shooting at every point, every corner, every place, 3 points. So why am I bringing that sport? It's so funny we're speaking so much about sport today, but it's because I have a very confronting conversation with the founders saying, look, are you willing to do the work? If you're willing to do the work, we can make it happen. You want to play like Michael Jordan? No problem. No problem. But you're not born like Michael Jordan. Therefore, Michael Jordan put 3 hours in the gym, you're going to put 4 hours in the gym. And then when people start to do the work, they're like, you know what? Actually, I don't want to be Michael Jordan. And again, no judgment. The challenge is the la la land, the in between. I want to be Michael Jordan, but I want to play only half an hour a day. That's where the problem is.
And that's a great point because sticking with the athlete metaphor, a lot of athletes, they will retire not because they can't play the game. They can still play the game. They can't do the work anymore that's required to allow them to play the game at the level they want to.
Yes.
Derek Jeter didn't stop because he couldn't play shortstop anymore. He stopped because he couldn't take the 150 swings of the tee every single day anymore without pain, And it's not about the game, but I think it comes back around to the discipline
It's
of what it
the level
takes
he
to
was
play
playing
the
on.
game at the level you want to play the game.
And also, it's very hard to go down to the next level. Look, I had a big company, then I lost it all, right? And I think one of the most emotional challenges for me was to go back to basic. Because I ran a big company, I ran a public company. Suddenly you wake up, you're like, oh, you're now the secretary, the cleaning lady, and the CFO and the CEO at the same time, because you start from scratch. So a lot of people go like, look, if I'm not playing on that level anymore, if I'm not playing for the, National League. I'm not playing anymore.
Yeah, that's true. We touched on it, but let's talk about it. AI, because AI is entering every conversation, and we're entering a period where it seems that AI is poised to reshape so many business functions. What concerns you most about how the leaders that you're speaking with and working with are approaching AI right now?
Look, I think if you say you know the answer, you're full of it. Because none of us do, whether you're Elon Musk or, or a person who's running a newsstand. No one knows what's going to happen. But the storm is coming our way. Winter is coming, as they say in Game of Thrones, winter is coming. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but winter is coming, right? So, working with people, there's two reactions. One is, it's not my, I don't care, I'm too old. It's not my business. Let me just squeeze a few more years out of it and then I'll be fine, right? It's no big deal. There's a lot of other hypes in the future, in the past. It's another hype. I think that's a dumb attitude because it's not another tool. It's a fundamental change to humanity. And I'm not saying it lightly, literally, fundamental change. Because every other tool we can turn off, this one we cannot. And I'm not talking about the philosophical element of AI. We're not going to go there. There's not a podcast about that.
No.
Okay? But literally, you need to like, but you need to wake up. As a business owner, you have to be like, look, the world I live in is not going to be the world that either I will be living in 5 years, or my kids, or my grandchildren, if I want to do a family business. Therefore, and no one knows how it's going to turn out, you need to spend time being fascinating, curating, spending money on it. If you're drowning under work and your desk is full of stuff and you don't spend half an hour, 45 minutes a day learning AI, trying, going to conferences, listening to podcasts, listening to conversation about what will AI do to your business, meeting with startups who's doing trying to change, you're going to be that business that before Amazon came around, but 10,000 times bigger. All those stores, I mean, like, look, my father-in-law, who I love dearly, right, owned a camera store in Manhattan for years. They were in the peak, second or third gen largest camera stores in the US. And then
Wow.
Amazon came, and they're like, you know, three brothers working very hard, immigrants, made it. But they did not see what's coming their way, and they ran out of business. Declare bankruptcy. Because there was two changes. One is smartphones, because they made so much money from developing films. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is Amazon. So take that, times 10,000, that's what's coming your way.
Yeah.
So if you're not fascinated by it, and I'm telling you, and again, I love the guy, but if I went to my wife's uncle, and I would look at his schedule, I guarantee you, looking back, he did not spend any time learning what's happening in the market. He was so busy working in the business, he was not opening his eyes to what's happening with Amazon, with logistics, with film, et cetera. So he was keep on doubling down on his business, and one day, boom, the gone business was gone.
Wow. So on the other side of that, where do you think AI can create real opportunity for the family governed B2B organizations like the listeners of this show?
Yeah. Look, the best advisory board is online right now. So I have a little practice. It's not great, but it's good. I have my own advisory board. I listened to someone speaking about it, and I was like, I'm going to take it because, you know, if you see something, you hear something brilliant, steal it and take it and make it yours. So it's definitely not my idea. But one other thing I do is I have a weekly meeting for 20 minutes just talking to AI, and I put on my advisory board the most extraordinary people in the world. I never have access to them. So I have Michael Bloomberg, I have the CEO of Microsoft on my board. I have all those people because I wanted to look for people who have a lot of material out there because, you know, AI can learn from a lot of material. If you're not someone no one knows, it's hard for AI to generate a thinking like you, right? But if you're someone who did a lot of writing or writing about, and I advise with them every week, and I'm like, well, what will you know? You know, what will you think about it? You know, Michael, hey, it literally gives you like, wow, Michael Bloomberg will say, look, why am I doing it? It's not really that effective. It's about training my brain to be elastic. So from how long it takes you to answer emails to governance, look, in the past, I mean, let's look and Ed, tell me if I'm losing you there. I don't think I do, but
No.
the reason why you went to Harvard or one goes to Harvard is because of the size of library. Think about 100 years ago, the reason why your family, if they can get in, sent you to Princeton or Harvard or wherever it is because the libraries were the richest libraries in the world, Oxford, Cambridge, you know, because that was the access to knowledge. Who cares about the size of the library now in the university? It's right at the end of your palm, right? So governance, issues in your family, if you're dealing with somebody in your sister, or your dad, or your COO you have to fire, go talk with ChatGPT. Go talk with, you know, with Claude, because the information can help you think. Don't let it do the thinking for you. That's a mistake lazy people do right now with AI. They ask AI to give them solutions. But if you actually train going ping pong, back and forth, and what about this? They have access to all the case studies of the top university in the world. Tens of thousands of businesses who dealt with this. If you think that your problem is probably special, I guarantee you, I work with so many companies. I never go like, wow, I never heard that one before. It's a different version, different take. The father is this way, or the son is this way, or the client is that way, but it's the same problem because it's humans. So that's the opportunity in AI, that you can actually tap into an extraordinary resource that can help you with governance, with laws, with regulation. You can save a lot of money on legal stuff. You know, I pay now, but I tell my attorney, I'm like, I'm paying you something a month, and I just got to review stuff. And he's like, why did you hire some attorney? I said, yes, AI. Because every time you used to charge me $600 for a letter, I write the letter with AI and I said, just review it. And if it's like, I know it's very simple, I don't even ask him to review it. Look, you know.
So you know we talked before about motivation. We talked about the importance of structure. So in this AI-driven world we're in now, it's moving very fast. Certainly faster than any other technological advancement in my industry or others that I can recall in my career. What structures would you think the companies need the most right now to manage in this pace, in this environment?
Well, that's a really good question, Ed. I would say the structure of human, the fabric of the company, because technology is changing so fast, there's no one who will be able to catch up to it. I mean, look at AI. I mean, I had a problem with my, I use ChatGPT, I pay the $20 a month, right? And it did really crappy work on Excel. So I moved to Claude and I came back a week later and did amazing work in Excel. Within a week, they fixed it. And you know, I think the biggest thing is to invest in your people. In the fabric where people are scared, people are worried to be replaced, people are angry, people are anxious, as you are, as the business owner. So if you ask me what systems to invest in, it's not in the software, it's in the hardware called human. Because they're going to be the one who's going to help you solve the problem. Because if you think you're going to solve the problem, good luck. You have the wrong team around you. But if you have a team that is committed and you can actually come to them and say, here's what I'm dealing with. I don't know the answer for this one. I know the answer for that one. We're going to try this and I'm not sure it's going to be successful. I'm going to try and see. And I want feedback for you. Then you'll be able to not only survive the storm, but thrive through the storm.
Yeah, it was this morning I was actually listening, and I when I do that I will listen to something every day, and I actually have a an AI project just teach me something new, that relates to AI driven growth for family governed B2B organizations. So every day I'm learning something new. But the podcast I was listening to was talking about some of the commencement speeches, and a lot of them had AI, interwoven messages. And a lot of the speakers were booed off stage by the college graduates. And they were booed off stage largely because a lot of the messaging is around how AI is going to obliterate a lot of these entry-level jobs and, create some potential real problems down the road, if not near term, longer term. When you hear things like that, what's your reaction to that? When you're, because certainly a lot of our listenership is also not just the people that are established or involved or engaged in the family business, but some of those young people that are at the crossroads. Do I
Yes.
join? Do I take another path? So what's your message to young people right now?
Look, there was an article, I don't know if you saw it today or yesterday in the Wall Street Journal about being exactly what you said. People are booing, and then throwing, a bomb at the house of, the founder of OpenAI and like trying to threat like death threat. Here's how I feel about it. Whether you do it or not, it's coming your way, buddy. So people, if you look back at history, people burned down textile factories. People, because that was a threat to the old way of doing things. But you and I mean, that lovely jacket you have on was not sold by, maybe you are fancy, Ed, but I don't think it was sold hand purely only by a hand, hand tailor. It was done by machines. So I'm not saying that there's no challenge in what AI is going to do. You should be worried. You should be worried because a storm is coming your way. Now, what are you going to do with it? That's a much more empowering conversation to have. Not will it happen or not. And if you think that you're going to burn the factory, the textile factory is going to slow down processing of cotton in the 18th or 17th century, good luck. Good luck. But if you look through history, every time a transformational technology was introduced, people, the old guards, stood against it. And I'm not judging them. I can see why. Look, I have three kids. They're probably, but it's coming our way. So if it's coming your way, be ready. And
True.
understand, look, if you want to be a driver, a truck driver can make $150,000 a year. As long as you understand that your career is probably going to disappear between 5 to 10 years from now. Now, there's nothing wrong to say I'm going to do it for the next 5, 10 years. I'm going to do a transition. I think our government should be stepping up and training people in the new way of doing it and training them to think differently, moving them to other energies, to other abilities, okay, because we have a responsibility as a society to take care of people. But you can go and make, because right now there's this gap between not enough drivers and not sufficient technology to have self-driving cars and trucks, mainly trucks. So enjoy it for the fact, make more money than trucks ever, truck drivers ever made in 5 to 10 years. And then understand it's coming to an end.
So, wanted to just before we wrap up, touch on another subject that I've certainly been noticing with a lot of CEOs that we're working with. They seem just to be incredibly overwhelmed, somewhat distracted at times, or maybe even reactive at times. So I don't know, I haven't exactly framed the why, but I've seen it fairly, sustained, for the last, certainly this calendar year. Do you see that too? And if so, would that be a leadership problem? Is that a systems problem, or is that just a cultural problem? Just that's the world we're living in now is far more complicated and complex for the CEO. So they're just dealing with more and maybe overextending a bit as a result.
Look, I think that the nature of a CEO is to be overwhelmed. If you don't want to be overwhelmed, work for the US Post Office. No judgment. Wrap it up at 4, go to your local, river, throw something, catch a fish, take a long break, go pension 62, 65, whatever it is. So understand the game you want to play. And I give this the third time we bring up the game. Because it's not about judging, just decide. So now, if you chose to be a CEO, we are going through a difficult time because see, it's so easy to be busy. I can walk into, I'm willing to give money back on this one, okay? I'm willing to walk into your calendar and chop 20 to 25% of your schedule without impacting for a second your effectiveness. We are so fascinated, obsessed, and take pride in being busy that we are shitty managers. I literally can cut through the, the flesh. 20, 25% of your time, so you can be with your kids, or get in better shape, or read a book, or study about AI, or increase the revenues of a business by 300%. I'm not telling you what to do. You might be spending more time with your kids. You want to triple the size of your company. But people are so, they're so self-important about how busy I am. Oh, I get to work at 5 and I leave 5 a.m. and I leave at 9 p.m. Okay, fine. There's some cases when it's needed. There was a period of my life when I worked my butt off. We're really early, really late. But a lot of it is fluff, especially as time progresses. Because you can't operate at like top performance at all the time. I think you just love being important. And part of feeling important is being busy. So we create this culture when people drive by the office and see the lights on 9 p.m. and say, "Oh, look, my employees are working." You're like, no, they hang out by the coffee machine, because because the brain cannot work for 16 hours all the time every day. So they drag it. They check social media. They do this. I love the Bloomberg. The second time bringing Bloomberg, that I don't know if you know the story about his table, is the desk. Like, he used to have morning meetings. And one day the team came in and there was no chairs, no table. And they're like, "Well, are we sitting for a morning meeting?" He's like, "No, I'm gonna do it standing." Because people come in and they said, "Hey, how was your day, Ed?" And so the meeting became 45 minutes. And he's like, "I'm gonna do meetings in standing." And it was like suddenly a 10-minute meeting. And it was the same material covered. So that's the thing. What I think, stop being so interested and showing off how ineffective you are and how busy you are. Start being really effective, so you can either squeeze out of more out of your business or squeeze out more out of your life.
That's a great point because I think a lot of people, and I'll put myself in this camp. For many years, I used the business as an excuse for a lot of things that maybe I couldn't do or wanted to do but couldn't get around to. I want to be in better shape, but I can't. I don't have time because of the business. And then I lost about 90 pounds and
Wow.
found that
Good for you.
hey, you can actually be. In fact, and as I was in that journey, I found that you know what. Daily exercise makes me more productive, not less.
Exactly. It spills to the other thing. That's one thing. My top performance, zenith is, it's all about stop compartmentalizing your successes. Because when you get in top shape, you get to become a business, a better business person. When you become a better business person, you actually become a better dad. When you become a better dad, become a better partner. When you become a better partner, become a better business person. So it's like this like circle. That one touch to the other, it spills over. If you master and develop muscles as a top performer, as a leader, it will spill to areas that you have no idea that they're coming your way.
Well, Boaz, I feel like we could talk for hours, if not days, but I do have to wrap this up. So, last question. If any of our listeners wanted to connect with you to learn more about what you're doing, your journey, or your coaching, speaking, books, or even the Zenith Clubhouse, what's the best way for them to connect?
Yeah, so I'll say, so first of all, Ed, thanks for the opportunity. And also, I want to say, I really took on when I left real estate to make an impact in people's lives. So I'm always making myself available. So whatever it is, you don't have to buy my course. Literally, I like to help people, right? And I would love if you buy, but I have a book. So you can either find me on LinkedIn, or you can go to boazgilad.com, or you go to zenithclubhouse.com. Or you can read my weekly articles at Substack, social media. And I mean, like in today's world, we're everywhere, So any place, shoot me a text. Say, "I want you to come talk to my team. I want you to give us a workshop to elevate our performance." Or, "I'm dealing with a challenge and I need advisory." Or, "I'm just dealing with something in my life and I want to do a program." Or, "I want to do the Zenith Clubhouse," which is a very structured course of 3 months that really kicks your butt and takes you to the next level, and your life completely change after that. But I'm saying you might not want that. You would just like, "I'm doing a retreat for my team and I want someone to talk to them." So I'm always available and I'll work with
Wonderful.
you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So to wrap it up, what stands out, Boaz, in your story is that performance is not just built haphazardly or during easy periods or simple periods. It's really revealed during true pressure, uncertainty, failure, as well as transition. And for family business, especially, those moments tend to expose whether the organization has real structure, discipline, and adaptability beneath its surface. As technology, AI, and market expectations continue to accelerate and change, those questions are only becoming more important. Boaz, thank you for sharing your story and your perspectives. Again, we've been speaking with Boaz Gilad, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Boaz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning in to Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeliaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed Delia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.